Sir Adrian Bolt conducted the London Philharmonic Orchestra in that performance of the final movement of Vaughan Williams' Symphony No. 9, commissioned by the Royal Philharmonic Society and first performed in 1958. Vaughan Williams died just a few months later. And you can join Donald MacLeod again tomorrow at the same time for more musical commissions from the 200-year history of the Royal Philharmonic Society. That's Composer of the Week tomorrow at 6:30. Or if you prefer, the programme has its first outing here on Radio 3 at midday. Tomorrow's featured Royal Philharmonic Society commissions include Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony and the Concerto Bartok, made from his sonata for two pianos and percussion. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and live online. 7:30, time now to go to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Katie Derham.
Hello, thank you, and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for a prom with a strong Russian theme. The massed ranks of the BBC Philharmonic are taking their places on the stage here, awaiting their conductor laureate, Gianandrea Noseda, with whom they're going to be performing a programme which includes Tchaikovsky's Second Symphony, known as the Little Russian, and Prokofiev's Second Piano Concerto. Soloist Jean-Eflamme Bavouzet will be doing the honours for that. One of the toughest challenges in the repertoire, one of the most dramatic too. We'll have the world premiere of Edward Cowie's latest work. It's the first ever planned series, drawing attention to some of the most stunning and threatened places in the world. The piece tonight is called Earth Music One, and it's inspired by the Great Barrier Reef. And we'll hear more about it from the composer and about how he's inspired and fascinated by science a little later on in this programme. But the concert is going to get off to a terrific start with two excerpts from Borodin's unfinished opera, Prince Igor. Borodin, another Renaissance man who combined science and music, a kindred spirit to Edward Cowie. In fact, that could be why he never really got round to finishing the opera. He'd worked on it for 18 years, but had never written the libretto. After his death, his friends, Rimsky-Korsakov and Glazunov, had the job of stitching together what material there was and filling in any gaps. The final version was premiered in 1880, and we're going to hear the overture and the Poloptsian dances, a sequence which tells the tale of Prince Igor and his son being entertained by their fierce but noble captors. The music is a really great example of Russian nationalism in the 19th century as the empire expanded into Central Asia. So we have Russian folk themes combined with exotic Orientalism. Borodin, the composer, was born the illegitimate son of a Georgian prince and his mistress. He was actually registered as a serf on his father's country estate, but he enjoyed a cultured education in which the sciences vied for attention with his musical accomplishments. He graduated with distinction from the St. Petersburg Medical Surgical Academy, but he was also the fifth of the five, or the mighty handful, of nationalist composers in mid to late 19th century in Russia. Well, coming to the stage now is the leader of the BBC Philharmonic, Yuri Tochinsky. And here comes Gianandrea Noseda, conductor laureate of the BBC Philharmonic, coming onto the stage now to conduct the overture and Poloptsian dances from Borodin's Prince Igor.
Thank you.
Heroics sweeping across the Russian steps there. Exotic charm galore from Luya. BBC Philharmonic, conducted by their erstwhile chief conductor, Gianandrea Noseda. Really vigorous, colourful playing there from the BBC Phil. And you can hear the response in the packed Royal Albert Hall. That was the overture to Borodin's Prince Igor and the Polotsian dancers. And the dancers became very well known in the West when the impresario Diaghilev put on a production in Paris in 1909 with choreography by Fokin, Mikhail Fokin. Became very famous at that point. And I should add, actually, that one of my guests on Proms Extra on Saturday, the superstar ballerina Tamara Rocco, who's now the new artistic director of the English National Ballet, is here somewhere tonight. She said she wanted to come to this one just to see the dancers from Prince Igor. Gianandrea Noseda, who's going to be putting on a production of the opera Prince Igor at the Met in New York next year in February and March. It's shockingly almost 100 years since the Met last produced this opera. Very well regarded for his Russian repertoire. He was the first non-Russian chief guest conductor at the Mariinsky Theatre. But from the Borodin and Prince Igor, we're going to move forward 30 years or so in our Russian theme tonight to the second piano concerto written by Prokofiev. With his first piano concerto, many thought Prokofiev was, and I quote, slapping the public in the face. He was certainly a provocative young man, as well as hugely talented. With his second piano concerto, he wasn't afraid to ruffle a few feathers either. One comment after the premiere of the work we're about to hear tonight was that it sounded like cats fighting. He was most assuredly a musical enfant terrible in the years before the Russian Revolution, and he cultivated novel dissonances while he was still a student pianist composer at the St. Petersburg Conservatory. He'd written the second piano concerto in the summer of 1913 while he was on holiday in Europe with his mother, and he dedicated it to the memory of a dear friend from the conservatory who'd committed suicide. It has the reputation of one of the toughest in the piano repertoire to play. There are some pretty big names who have, it's said, refused to touch it for fear of coming unstuck. Well, our soloist tonight, Jean Eflam Bavouzet, has a healthy respect for the technical challenges. Indeed, his fingers were taped up today to protect them from the ravages of the rehearsal. He plays all the Prokofiev piano concertos. Indeed, he's recording the second one with the BBC Philharmonic in the next couple of days. When I spoke to him earlier, though, he was really keen to play down the virtuosic element and concentrate on the dramatic.
There is really, frankly, no equivalent, as far as I could see, in the piano literature of technical challenges like the second movement being, the two hands being absolutely parallel from A to Z at a very fast speed. It needs, let's say, a kind of a muscular stamina or to achieve to play this concerto, or the jumps in the fourth movement, or the colossal cadence in the first movement. But to reduce it as just a very, very difficult piece, of course, is not making justice to this probably one of the most dramatic gesture ever written, in at least in the format of piano concertos.
And why do you call it the most dramatic ever written?
We know the circumstance in which Prokofiev wrote it, losing a very, very dear friend. There is a new dimension of lyricism. Prokofiev is a great master of marvelous melodies and tunes that stays in your ears. I'm not surprised that Prokofiev was not a great admirer of Debussy. He liked Ravel much better. Ravel, who, by the way, was a great melodist as well.
And playing with the BBC Philharmonic and Gianandrea, Noseda conducting tonight, you have a good relationship with the orchestra and with him, I know.
Oh, much more than good. it's a very warm and very fruitful and inspiring collaboration.
Jean-Eflam Bavouzet talking there about the Prokofiev and about the orchestra, who are just retuning now the piano is on stage for him. And it is interesting to note that two of Prokofiev's concertos have never been played at the Proms, which does say something about, well, I guess about their popularity, but also, I'm thinking, about their trickiness too. Jean-Eflam is a multi-award winner for his recordings of Debussy and Ravel, of Haydn sonatas and of Bartok concertos. He first came to public attention after being invited by Georges Scholti to perform with the Orchestre de Paris in 1995, and he's widely recognised as that particular maestro's last major discovery. As for his name, A small pub quiz fact for you here. He was born in a village called Saint-Eflamme near Lannion in Brittany. So hence the Jean Eflamme. Now, Schulte might have made Jean Eflamme's career, but his debut was pretty lucky too. When he was 17, his first concert in Paris was cancelled because a storm had created a hole in the roof of the hall. The great Yogi Schifter heard what had happened to him and offered him the second half of his own concert the following week. Instead of having just his family sitting in the hall, therefore, he played before an entirely sold-out audience with the press. Quite lucky. He has a very warm relationship with tonight's conductor, Jean-André Macedo, with whom he's worked many times, although this is the first time they've actually performed this work together. Well, it is a dramatic piece we're going to hear, and the two of them are coming onto the stage now to perform Prokofiev's second piano concerto. It's in four movements, quite rare for piano concerto, and it is going to be, I think, rather an exciting performance. Jean-Eflamme Bavizot taking the seat at the piano now, Jean-André Macedo taking to the podium.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Cheers for Jean Flambabouzé and for the BBC Phil, conducted by Gianandrea Noseda. Prokofiev's second piano concerto. What a performance. Gianandrea and Jean Flam grasping each other and congratulating each other on a job extremely well done. Wonderful, flamboyant playing, sometimes almost puckish, I would say. There was that sort of feeling, wasn't there, of playfulness during that concerto, certainly in the interpretation we heard there from Jean Flam as he scampered up and down the keyboard. Extraordinary feats of virtuosity there. From where I was sitting, you know, you could sometimes barely see his fingers move, they were going so fast, it was just a blur. And he's back on stage, blowing kisses to all the orchestra. Patting the leader, Yuri Tuchinsky, warmly on the shoulder as he passes to take another bow. Prokofiev premiered that work in a grand country house to an audience of society types, polite ladies. And you can just imagine what the reaction was. You really can imagine he was having a bit of a laugh, I would say, with his audience as they were shocked by his harmonies. Well, the cheers and the bows continue. Gianandrea spoke very warmly to me earlier of Jean Flambabouzé. Said he particularly appreciates the way Jean Flam blows dust off the interpretations of the works that he performs. The original score had quite a dramatic life. Prokofiev had abandoned Russia for America in 1918, and he left the orchestral score of this concerto behind, and then a few years later learned it had been destroyed. Apparently the new tenants in his apartment had burned it to cook an omelette. Although, as Andrew Huff comments in tonight's programme, that probably wasn't thoughtless vandalism, but evidence rather of the terrible conditions in Petrograd during the Civil War, when people were dying of cold and hunger. The version that we heard played tonight was, in fact, the rewritten version that Prokofiev then took upon himself to write. More cheers, more bowing. Is this bow number four? I think so. The whole orchestra on their feet again. Well, as Jean Flambabouzé leaves the stage, I think for the final time with Gianandrea Noseda, it's worth saying that this year, of course, at Proms 2013, it is a big year for piano concertos. Next one you'll be able to hear is on Wednesday. That'll be Louis Lorty playing the Lutosławski piano concerto. So do tune in for that. It's time now, though, for the interval. In the second half of tonight's concert, we're going to hear Tchaikovsky's Second Symphony. We're also going to hear a brand new work inspired by the Great Barrier Reef from the pen of Edward Cowie, and I'll be talking to him later about that. In its honour, for the next 20 minutes, we have a specially commissioned short story written by Evie Wilde about a couple aiming to make a fresh start with a tour of the Great Barrier Reef. The Reef is read by Penny Downey.
They have been coming now for 3 days. A light flick on the surface of the water sometimes, other times, the full fin. Norrie, what are those? Marge had asked the first time she saw them, keeping her voice unhysterical. He looked, used his binoculars, then his plain sight. Can't see nothing, doll, he'd said, and pointed his binoculars back up at the crested terns that wheeled above the boat. It seemed to Marge they were playing with her. Once, from the corner of her eye, she thought she saw one slide its body up out of the water, flashing her a white belly, and then disappear, leaving just a thick ripple in its wake. After that, she claimed the heat gave her a headache and went below deck and stayed there until Norrie came down for his tea. It was too long to be at sea. That was the thing. It was too long to be anywhere that wasn't home. The coffee tastes of seaweed again. Norrie, calls Marge. Norrie, the bloody coffee tastes of seaweed again. But Norrie, above deck, doesn't answer. He'll be midway up the mast with his binoculars, looking for the storm petrel he said he'd heard again in the early hours of the morning, getting them both up above deck to look. You take the water, love, he said, handing her the spare binoculars. I'll take the sky. But instead, she focused on the space between sky and sea where the land should have been. When she saw a fin in the water, she focused on the prow of the boat. Norrie! She calls him again. And again, no answer. Marge smashes down the coffee pot on the sideboard and swears when the coffee flies out of the spout and scalds her wrist. It's not that hot, really, but for a second she thinks she might cry because of the unfairness of it. They have been 19 days at sea. Norrie sees no reason to head back to land just yet. They have cans of soup, dried fruit, and beans enough for the same stretch of time again. Marge'd love an afternoon on the main street. Coffee with a fern pattern on the top of the frothed milk, a custard tart and a read of a book. Somehow at sea, her eyes can't settle on the page. The moment she sits down to read, she finds a reason to stand up again. She has a feeling that her vigilance is necessary. Like if she takes her eyes off the cramped space below deck, they'll spring a leak and go down. Though the mess of the boat feels impossibly small at times, it's better than the unruly distance she sees all around them when she is above deck. It is better than seeing her husband happy and not knowing exactly why. Instead of crying, Marge tips the coffee down the sink and watches as it comes right back up. What does that mean? She wonders. The idea came to them 5 years ago, a round Australia trip like you saw people taking on travel shows on the television, just the two of them, the boat, the sea and the sky. Marge had been the one to suggest it, that day when Norrie came home from work and wouldn't get out of his car. Just sat there in the driveway, staring straight ahead without switching off the engine. Her heart had started to beat high in her chest. It was all going to start again. She'd sat in the passenger seat, leant over and turned off the ignition, passed the car key into her pocket and lay her hand on his knee. She knew not to speak first. The car heated up quickly without the air conditioner on, but she had stayed still, watched a trickle of sweat run down the side of her husband's pale face. I don't know what there is to look forward to anymore, he'd said eventually in a voice that sounded like it hadn't been watered. It's like all of a sudden I've come to the end of things. In 5 years I'll just be sat on that veranda waiting to die. That had stung. And though Marge knew there was something dreadful in the loosening of her skin and the tender pouches that had appeared underneath her eyes, that a pain in her legs kept her awake at night, she thought the kids were a triumph he couldn't ignore. Surely he took encouragement from Roddy, a grown young man with the kind of job and salary that didn't exist when they were his age. And Wanda, with the three kids, the grandkids for heaven's sake, wasn't that enough? They'd done that for them. They'd provided the soil to grow, the nourishment to put roots down into. They'd done that with their own hands in their own good earth. Marge had pulled a tissue from her sleeve and blown a nose and put her hurt to the back of her mind and said, well, then, we won't just sit on the veranda waiting to die. We'll do something other when you retire. We'll rent out the house and go on an adventure. And a story had spilled out, fresh from a travel brochure. The opal sea, the white stretches of sand, the coral, and above all of those, birds. Hadn't he always wanted to be able to name the seabirds? She watched as Norrie came back into himself, saw him listen to her like a child, the colour returning to his face. He'd agreed to come out of the car with her, and they'd spent the rest of the evening on the veranda where Norrie was afraid to die, shared a bottle and then two. When they became drunk, they ordered hot chips from the shop on the main street. The delivery man had smiled at them, had rolled his eyes, implying, Marge thought, irritated, that they were naughty schoolchildren. We'll show you, she thought. That night, lost in the stories she'd told, Marge imagined waving to the delivery man inside his sweaty shop as they drove by, a sizeable yacht attached to their car. She thought of the beautiful silver-finned tailor at the fishmonger, the cool stroke of the swell she loved on her morning swims, the salt that would fluff out her hair like she was the carefree hippie she'd always hoped she could be. And Norrie had gone off to work the next day, and when he came back he talked of nothing else. And when the 5 years were up, the men at work bought Norrie and Marge, his and hers, yellow sou'westers, their names embroidered in pink and blue on the top pockets. And that was the first real strike of alarm Marge had felt. Because in her imaginings of the trip, the sea had always been calm. Norrie! The deck creaks above her, and she knows that he can hear her, that he's shutting her out. Norrie, what does it mean when water comes up through the plug hole? She pictures them sinking, the slow suck of the water taking them down, the salty burn and the sudden stillness. The white bellies on the other side of the wall of the boat, the single floating leg. Marge climbs the ladder halfway. Norrie! She is standing on a mid-rung of the ladder and her face is at knee height to him. He is looking straight up to the sky with those binoculars arching his back in a way that looks uncomfortable and like he might fall backwards at any minute. Marge resists the urge to ask him to be careful. It will only make him more reckless. Birds spin and rail above him. She can see his gums from where he's either squinting at the sun or smiling like a madman. Lesser crested tern, he says loudly, as if it's an answer to a question. He looks down at her, blinks out the sun. His face is a crab shell of pink, apart from a line of white zinc down the middle of his nose. A prize idiot, Marge finds herself thinking, and feels unkind. Norrie, water is coming up through the plug hole. Norrie looks at her a moment, still blinking. Well, we're in the Pacific Ocean, Dahl. Water's coming up through everything. He leans back again, puts the binoculars to his face and is lost once more. Marge does not feel listened to. Something does not feel right. She concentrates on not looking past her husband at the water. She senses them there. Long fins cutting through the water at the side of the boat, mouthing the outboard. Norrie, she says, taps his varicose-veined calf. What, he says, a rare bit of annoyance leaking out. Marge feels stupid. The unadventurous type her mother-in-law had once said of her, pretending she meant it as a compliment. It's just the coffee tastes of seaweed again. Norrie sighs. Drink tea, then. There's no milk, says Marge, but to herself. Again she feels the prickling in her nose and she makes fists of her hands and digs her nails into her palms. There's a loud splash near the prow, which could be anything. A large wave, a porpoise, a fish leaping. Anyway, it's the water that's the problem. But he's back in the sky, chasing the arc of a fat white bird. Marge climbs back down into the body of the boat. At this time of day, no one should be above deck. The sun shrinks the eyelids. Salt stretches your skin and threatens to peel it from your face. She runs her finger across her top lip, which has a ripple in it where the nastier skin cancer had been. A childhood spent deliberately roasting her face around the back of the family pub because she liked the way it made the skin tight. Her brother sneaking her lemonade and beer in hot afternoons, and her mother chucking her a bag of potato chips for tea. She used to have a rosebud mouth. Norrie's childhood was spent in less feral company, his mother moving them across Europe, showing them how to eat oysters. Those vile little sacks of ointment Norrie's mother carted out for every one of Marge's birthdays so she could sit and watch Marge try and force one down, swimming in Tabasco, shallots, lemon juice and vinegar and anything to take away that wicked, wicked texture. Like a mouthful of the ocean, Norrie's mother would say every time, a look of bliss on her face that only came after she'd seen the stifled wretch in Marge's throat. Marge sits on the edge of the bunk that she had meticulously made 2 hours previously. "You don't need to bother about that, love," Norrie had said that morning. "Who's going to see if you leave it unmade?" And the terrible thought was, no one. There'd be no stopover from the grandkids. No one would get up on her bed with their gumboots still on and grind Tim Tams into the quilt. She lies down on the top of the made bed. More and more she finds herself dozing during the day, spending as little time as possible above deck. She doesn't like to think of them swimming alongside the boat. Doesn't like to point them out to Norrie, who won't see them. Here at sea, the idea of death comes to her in a way it never did on dry land. Norrie doesn't fear death in the same way that she does. When she quizzed him on the danger of the trip while they tried on their sou'westers for size, he'd shrugged. "All gotta go some way," he'd said. "I'd rather go out with a bang than stay here and get old," he said, gesturing at the garden. The yellow sun warming the succulents, the lavender glow off the jacaranda, the bird table holding a clutch of rosellas. It's not the same for Marge. Not the same at all. Death at sea feels like the worst kind of death. Death in bed, surrounded by family, safe to the last, that's what she wants. And not now. Not after both of them had a clean bill of health for the insurance company. And Wanda, pregnant again. Poor Wanda, she thinks. Sometimes she questions whether she named her that off the back of the unadventurous type comment. She closes her eyes and listens to the slap and huck of the water against the hull, thinks of a dozen fish just on the other side of the fiberglass. 100 fish, silver with large button eyes. 1,000. The plug hole makes a gurgling sound, deep and guttural. Marge's eyes snap open. She rolls off the bed and goes to look. In the sink, 2 inches of clear water. She climbs the ladder again. This time, Norrie is at the end of the boat, starboard or port. Marge cannot get straight in ahead. "Norrie!" she calls, but a light breeze gets in her way and Norrie doesn't turn around. A flock of gulls are dive-bombing the water and the little left of Norrie's hair waves in the breeze. That night, Norrie sleeps the best sleep of his life, while Marge lies awake, listening to the slap and thud of the water against the hull. She lets her mind wander, and she thinks she can hear the reef creaking, or the hull grating up against coral, the puncture wound filling swiftly with water, the oyster smell she can't get out of her nose. She pictures them becoming part of the reef, pictures waking to find the mainsail crusted over, the helm stuck hard, cemented, the engine, a porcelain sculpture, Norrie's hands folded on the lump of his chest like one of those European kings, his breath stopped in water, a small clownfish in his mouth finding slim pickings between his dentures. Marge slides out of bed, watching to make sure Norrie isn't disturbed. She has already packed and stowed the food in a felt bag, the way she does every couple of nights. It makes her sweat to climb the ladder, but she has her excuse ready if he wakes and asks her what she's doing. She'll pretend to be sleepwalking. And maybe that will catch his attention. Maybe then he will think, my wife is in danger, I should take her home. But Norrie sleeps on. And Marge slides away the lid and climbs out into the salt air of the night. It is still. The moon is a bright and faraway glow. Before they'd come, she'd imagined it large and full and fat, being produced out of the sea to provide artistic silhouettes. But it is not a friend to her. It is uninterested in what she has in her felt bag. Although the sea is flat, she gets a dizzying feeling as she walks, like the deck might tip her off into the black nothingness, where she will be taken away to one of those deep, dark patches of ocean where the sandy floor might well be the centre of the earth. She opens the first tin, something that calls itself chili, which neither of them would ever have eaten back home. It rolls off Marge's palm and lands with a smack in the water. The water is black, and there is nothing to see. In the stillness, she thinks suddenly that she'd like to see them straight on, that she'd like to know them. What are they, after all? Only fish. Only big fish like the ones they'd caught in the first week and barbecued on deck before Norrie heard the petrel that first time and turned his gaze upwards. She lets another can fall, cream of chicken, but sees nothing other than the flurry of white water when it hits the surface. She purses her lips and makes a kissing noise, like the one she makes for the cat back home. She tries a few tongue clicks too, empties a small bag of dry kidney beans like she's pouring kibble into a bowl. "What's that you're doing, doll?" Norrie is suddenly beside her, looking into the water too, and Marge jumps, her heart thumping. She tries to think of something to say, leaves it a little too long to play the sleepwalking card, and Norrie is looking at her felt bag of food and how she's holding an empty packet of beans. "I'm feeding them," she says, though it wasn't what she had thought she was doing until now. "Who are you feeding?" Norrie is not acting the way she expected him to. He is gentle. She expected him to be less calm about her pouring the last of their food into the sea. He doesn't press her when she remains silent. Both of them listen to the lap of the night water, the distant roar that is all around them of waves breaking on an unreachable shore. There is an intake of breath from Norrie. "Did you hear that?" he says, looking up at the black sky. Marge listens. "What?" "The petrel calling." Marge listens again, closely. "Oh," she says. "Yes, I hear it now," she says. Norrie's face opens in a way she'd forgotten about. "I hear it." They stand there, listening to the waves thundering, Norrie smiling so that his teeth shine white in the distant moonlight. He reaches for her hand and holds it, papery, warm. She squeezes back. A shark appears, its back shining in the moonlight. It dives in the water in the same way the porpoise do, graceful, unhurried. "Do you see them?" Marge asks. Norrie peers over the side of the boat, spends a while watching, and Marge holds her breath. "Yeah, I see them now," he says.
Penny Downey was reading The Reef, an original commission for Radio 3 by Evie Wilde. The producer was Robert Howells. But welcome back to tonight's Prom, a concert which has had Russian music, folk music in particular, at its heart. Next, we're going to hear the world premiere of a BBC Proms commission by Edward Carey to mark his 70th birthday. Always inspired by the natural world, this is the first of a series of works he's planning, which will, through his music, draw attention to the beauty and fragility of various natural wonders. Trips to the deserts and canyons of Utah are planned, then to the Arctic Circle and the Serengeti. But this first piece takes us just off the northeast coast of Australia to the Great Barrier Reef.
My life has always been, as a composer, has always been connected with being in places, wild places preferably. And I've always been really intrigued by and excited by the variety of dynamics of nature, not only the way it sounds, but the way it looks, the way it behaves, the shape of things moving, especially the conjunction between colour, the rhythm of things moving. So there's a very strong interlock between music, sound, and fine art seeing for me. So earth music, yeah, is to be the beginning of, I hope, a sort of long-term adventure, looking into places which are either under threat from human disturbance and being eroded and poisoned, or just places that are just stunningly beautiful. I want this piece, as many as any of the past pieces, but this piece, to take people into a place. I mean, they'll know, of course, it's about the sea in some sense, but they...
Because you were inspired by the Great Barrier Reef, is
that
right?
Yeah, I was. Yes. I mean, I was. But, you know, which actually, technically, is a soundless place. I mean, you look at it from the top, but once you're under the water, you only have the sound of bubbles in your ears. But when you get close, of course, it's incredibly noisy. The fish make sounds, they sing. Crustacea whistle and tweet. And then there's a rhythm and beat of coral, which are loose enough to beat against each other and make these extraordinary rhythms. So the very opening of the piece is, well, sunrise, but then the first dive, if you like, into this erstwhile silent world is one of incredibly complex intermeshing and interlocking forms.
Edward Carey, the composer there of Earth Music One, he spent a total of 80 hours, he was telling me, diving in the Great Barrier Reef. As he said, on the face of it, it's very silent until you're down there, and then you can hear that whistling of the crustaceans and the singing of the fish and the creaking of the coral. Listen to that in the piece you're going to hear. You'll hear that reflected in his sound world he's created. And he also told me that on one scientific trip, which he went on accompanied by a sort of rather extended diving trip, he was surprised by a shoal of 40 barracuda. Absolutely terrifying, it sounded. So think of that in the frenzied climax to the piece. Well, coming back onto the stage now is the conductor Gianandrea Noseda to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in Edward Carey's piece Earth Music One. This is the world premiere. Thank you.
Thank you.
The world premiere of the BBC Proms Commission Earth Music One by Edward Carey. And the composer is taking a bow. I'm sure delighted by the reaction of the crowd in the hall here to this particular work, which is the first of a series, as I mentioned earlier, drawing attention to fragile and endangered and yet beautiful areas of the world. Edward coming to the stage now to take a bow with Jan Andrea and the BBC Philharmonic. His first Proms commission was back in 1975, a work called Leviathan, premiered by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And the first major event in a career that was to gain the national and international recognition as a new kind of voice in the music world. And, you know, he's a composer with an imagination deeply embedded in and inspired by the forces of nature. And I'm pretty sure I spotted the barracuda. Now, this season at the Proms, we're hearing the entire cycle of Tchaikovsky symphonies, celebrating the composer who put Russia on the symphonic map. His six numbered symphonies fall into two distinct halves, the fourth, fifth and sixth, big emotional epics which inspired the likes of Mahler and Shostakovich. The first three were more polite, if you like. They were attractively scored, they were well-crafted, they didn't perhaps pack the most enormous punch. Tchaikovsky was desperately trying during this phase to find a symphonic language that would be distinctively Russian, but which would also compete with the likes of Liszt and his symphonic poems. Well, the second symphony was written in 1872. He was at his sister's holiday home in the Ukraine. The Ukraine used to be known as Little Russia, hence the nickname of the symphony. Tchaikovsky actually revised the second symphony considerably, only really finding its final shape after he'd finished his third and fourth symphonies. The symphony's second movement also rather craftily reuses material that he'd written for an unfinished opera called Undina. It's full of tunes inspired by Russian folk songs. It's very much part of its charm, as tonight's conductor Jan Andrea Noseda told me earlier.
The beginning of Tchaikovsky, of course, is not a folk tune, but it looks like, it sounds like. So Tchaikovsky was able to write, to compose absolutely personal music, but making it sound like a popular folk tune. And that's why the Second Symphony is called the Little Russia. Little probably because it's not a very long symphony, but Russia because there are many elements. Also the second movement, boom, 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 is a sort of march. There is a children's song.
Well, there might be a children's song in there perhaps, but it is a wonderful piece of work. One which is going to be performed by us for us in a minute by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Jan Andrea Noseda. As I said, we are celebrating all of Tchaikovsky's symphonies in the BBC Prom season this year. And here he comes now, back to the stage, to conduct Little Russian, Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 2 in C minor, Opus 17.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
The BBC Philharmonic on their feet. I don't know why that isn't performed more often. That was Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 2 in C minor, Opus 17, The Little Russian. Gianandrea Noseda conducting the orchestra, of which he used to be chief conductor. He's now their conductor laureate. And I think encourage the orchestra to a performance of great charm, which was enjoyed so thoroughly by everybody here in the Royal Albert Hall. And the final movement, you could hear a children's game song called The Crane, which was apparently sung to Tchaikovsky by his sister's butler while he was working on the score at her home in Ukraine, which used to be known as Little Russia. And to the extent that Tchaikovsky said the butler should get the credit for the whole symphony. We're just bringing David Chatwin, Principal Bassoon, to his feet. Before that, we had Andrew Budden, Principal Horn, receiving applause as well. Timpan is getting a big cheer. That was Paul Turner. And the entire brass section now on their feet. The BBC Phil having a great prom season. I don't know if you caught their dance prom not so long ago under their new chief conductor, Juan Pomena, who's been in charge for the last couple of years. They're still clearly extremely fond of Gianandrea Noseda, who is, as I speak, kissing all the ladies' hands on the front desks. No wonder they love him. You'll be able to hear them again tomorrow, the last prom they'll be giving actually this season. Their principal guest conductor, John Storgard, will be in charge, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the coronation with music by Walton and Rubra, and the first prom's performance of Korngold's only symphony. A big romantic blockbuster, if ever there was one, for those of you who like Gemala. That's one to tune into tomorrow evening here on BBC Radio 3. And as Gianandrea Noseda comes back out onto the stage to take another bow, it's worth mentioning that the composer of the piece we heard before the Tchaikovsky, Edward Carey, is in conversation at 10:15 on BBC Radio 3 with Andrew McGregor, talking about his work and indeed all the other works that he's written for the BBC films and beyond over the last 30, 40 years. But now I think it's time to wish you good night from the Royal Albert Hall. I do hope you've enjoyed the concert. And time for me to hand you back to Jonathan Swain, who's at Broadcasting House.
Katie, thank you very much. Katie Derham there at the Royal Albert Hall, and quite the swiftest Tchaikovsky Little Russian I think I've ever heard. Just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's prom here on BBC Radio 3 tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every prom's available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast. Well, the Edward Cowie Earth Music is certainly a piece I'd like to hear again. And as Katie was saying, there's a chance to find out more about Edward Cowie in a Proms composer portrait of him here on Radio 3. That's in just under 25 minutes at 10:15. And after it tonight, jazz on 3. This evening it comes from the 2013 Manchester Jazz Festival. That's from 11 o'clock. Well, Katie Darren mentioned tomorrow night's Prom, a fair measure of late romanticism, certainly in the case of the symphony by Korngold. Here it was Mahler recognised as something of a genius when Korngold was only 10. Well, this is a set of Korngold songs from a good many years on, 1947. I Wish You Bliss, Wings, Old Spanish Song, then Old English Song, and finally a Shakespeare setting, My Mistress' Eyes. The mezzo is Angelika Kirschlager and the pianist Helmut Deutsch. My Mistress Eyes, ending those five songs, Opus 38, by Korngold, the mezzo Angelika Kirschlager and the pianist Helmut Deutsch. I beg your pardon, apologies for the interruption, but I see the Korngold Symphony is in tomorrow night's prom along with the Max Bruch First Violin Concerto. That's a piece Bruch himself sometimes used to wish he'd never written for the public. Nothing else he wrote really measured up to it. And not that much has changed over the decades. So here's an outing for a romance he wrote in 1912 for the violin's bigger brother, the mellow-toned viola, the piece perhaps following in the tradition of the Beethoven violin romances. Yuri Bashmiet is the viola player here with Nemi Järvi conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. viola player Yuri Bashmet with Neyma Yervi conducting the LSO in Max Bruch's Romance Opus 85, music he wrote in 1912. Bruch wrote his first violin concerto, his most popular piece, at least 4 decades before that romance. His style didn't change much, did it? And that famous G minor violin concerto was in tomorrow night's Prom, played by the young Norwegian violinist Vilde Frung. Also in the Prom, the Korngold Symphony, along with 2 very different salutes to Her Majesty the Queen, Walton's Coronation March Auburn Scepter, and Edmund Rubra's Ode to the Queen. Jon Storgoj conducts the BBC Philharmonic, and that's live here on Radio 3 from the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow night, starting at 7:30. Well, just time for another of those Korngold songs before our Prom's composer portrait. This is another of his Shakespeare settings. Come Away, Death, the first of the Songs of the Clown, Opus 29, by Korngold, the mezzo-soprano Angelika Kirschlager and the pianist Helmut Deutsch.
I'm Donald MacLeod, and I've been writing and presenting Radio 3's Composer of the Week since 1999. The programme itself has been going a bit longer than that. This week's composer, as it was originally known, first hit the airwaves on the BBC Home Service 70 years ago. As part of our birthday celebrations this year, we want to put the spotlight on a composer who's never appeared on the programme before. And to do that, we need your suggestions. On the Composer of the Week webpage, you can find a list of all the composers we've ever featured over the last 7 decades. If there's someone you think we've unjustly overlooked, please let us know. You can send an email to composeroftheweek@bbc.co.uk, write us a letter, or tweet us at the hashtag COTW70.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. And now another of our Prom's composer portraits with Andrew McGregor.
Welcome. We're all here to find out more about composer Edward Cowie, the man behind Earth Music One, the world premiere in this evening's Prom. We're also going to have 3 world premieres in this Prom's composer portrait played by musicians from the Royal Northern College of Music. Now, Edward, the Prom's commission this evening explores the Great Barrier Reef and using a pretty large orchestral canvas. And I gather it's a while since you've really written for something for an orchestra of this size. Does your chamber music relate to a canvas of that kind of substance?
I suppose it's a bit like asking a painter whether working on the small-scale watercolours has a relationship with painting large canvases in oil. Those members of the audience here who know, say, the watercolours of J.M.W. Turner would know that even when they're very small scale, you have this monumental feeling about them. And if you look at the watercolours of Cézanne, a tremendous sense of scale. The palette is larger, the degree to which you can have intense mixes of colour is larger. But in terms of what the intent of music is about, which is, you know, obviously interests me very much, what do I feel, what do I think, and what do I want to impart to my audience? I can't say I approach writing for string quartet or solo marimba or solo piano differently from the orchestra, except that the orchestra is so massive, because I love landscape so much, and landscapes inspire me very much. When you're in a very intimate spot in a wood, you're almost compelled to look at things in great detail, every flower, every insect, every piece of texture of the wood on a trunk of a big tree. But when you're in a desert or a massive plain or a great mountain valley, then you are seeing something on a much more massive scale. And I think that was the sort of thing which drove me to feel, yeah, writing this piece for a large orchestra is a different habitat.
And so the pieces we're going to hear, there's a greater degree of intimacy, perhaps more of a focus on, if you like, an individual brush stroke or the line of a single pencil, perhaps.
I think that's true. Although, you know, when you write a piece, you obviously you hear it in your head, but when you see it, hear it, see it, realised by a performer, for example, the marimba piece, which I think is starting, you suddenly realise that actually scale is not a matter of size or volume. In fact, Henry Moore once wrote about scale in a book on sculpture. Scale is not a matter of size and dimensions, it's a matter of the number of marks upon a surface. And I think that one of the things which struck me about this first piece for a solo instrument, which is an African instrument, after all, the marimba, was its massiveness of scale. It has tremendous extremes of softness and loudness and of richness of texture and sparseness of texture. And really, you know, the way of looking at that is that it's not that much different from an orchestral palette when it's played like that.
It's no accident, of course, that we're talking about paint, we're talking about art, we're talking about drawings and all of these kinds of things, because that is very often, in fact, always, I think, your starting point, really, as part of the process of composition, or pretty close to it. The piece we're going to hear is called Blue Blues. Unpack the title for us, you have to.
Well, it was originally called Lake Eacham Blue. It's based on a painting by my wife, who did a series of paintings. She's an interesting artist in the sense that she paints sound, so that the works themselves are already, if you like, looking at the whole process the other way around. Lake Eacham is a place where, in fact, our relationship really started. It's a volcanic crater in North Queensland, surrounded by rainforest, jungle. It has the most amazing, it's 750 feet deep. It goes from all kinds of shades of cobalt and aquamarine right down into deep black jet colours. And it's surrounded by the most amazing tapestry of birds, exotic rainforest birds, which incant. I hope I'm not insulting Australians by saying I think most of their birds are jazzy. But there's a definite quality to Australian birdsong, which is improvisatory, sporadic, spurting, dynamic, explosive. At the same time, this piece is also trying to invoke the awesomeness of these tremendous depths and sheens of colour. So occasionally you will hear the marimba going into a rest phase, and you have just a very soft resonance, which is actually paradoxically meant to imply great depth, around which, if you will, from the top to the bottom of the marimba, we have songs, sounds of the crater, of the creatures around the crater, resonating from very high to very low.
Well, it's a fabulous range of sound and dynamic range, as you said. It's a 5-octave marimba, this. It's a world premiere performance. Please welcome to the stage percussionist Delia Stevens to play Blue Blues by Edward Cowie.
Thank you. Thank you.
Blue Blues by Edward Cowie, inspired by his wife Heather Cowie's paintings of Lake Eacham in Queensland, Australia. And that world premiere performance was given by marimba player Delia Stevens. And we have two more premieres ahead of us still in this Proms Composer Portrait dedicated to Edward Cowie's music. Now, Edward, you are as much a visual artist